Thank you. Be seated, everyone, please. We're heading to our third and final case of the day here at the University of Idaho College of Law. Welcome to visitors and in attendance at this hearing. The matter presented is an appeal involving Greenfield Family Trust versus Olive Fountain Land Company. The Greenfield Family Trust appeals today, and they are represented by Mr. Chad Friedman. Good morning. The respondent here is the Olive Fountain Land Company, represented by Benjamin Raskoff. Good morning.
Good morning.
Counsel, do either of you have preliminary matters for the court?
Nothing for me, Your Honor. For myself.
Thank you, then. Now, Mr. Friedman, you may proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the Board and Council, Chad Friedman here today on behalf of the Greenfield Family Trust. Today we have a narrow issue advanced to the question of whether the district court can find trespass, find that damage was the result of the trespass, but not award any damages for the diminution in value to the property, despite the only evidence with regard to value being undisputed. In Idaho, we have a rule that an owner can testify to the value of their own land. And that rule is because the owner is presumed to have, within reason, by comparison and by inquiries and purchase and sale, knowledge with regard to the value of their own property.
Counsel, is this the question as you describe it? Is it a rhetorical question? Is it? I guess what I'm wondering is this really an issue of fact that there was damages and the court ignored them, or is it an issue of every time a court finds trespass, it has to find damages as a matter of law?
It would be that if the court did find damages and ignored them, from my perspective, is because the undisputed evidence showed that there was 30 mature trees removed, there was a culvert that was cut, it caused flooding.
There was compensation, though, for the trees, and treble damages were applied, correct?
Correct, and if you look at under, I believe it's pronounced the Weeds case, they talk about timber that's taken away and harvested, and that being a value compared to with the estate value or the value to a property owner with regard to trees, and it's not just trees particularly in this case. We also have, you know, a section that was dug out and flooding that resulted in trails destroyed. So it kind of goes beyond just the harvested timber.
Right, counsel, but the language in Weeds about aesthetic value of the trees is about rehabilitation damage. It's not about diminution in value damage. Did you claim damages to rehabilitate the property?
Well, the damages that were presented to the court were for the loss of the market value.
Right, the diminution in value, right?
Correct.
And Weeds discusses aesthetic value as distinct, a different type of damage than diminution in value, doesn't it?
It does. One of the things that is important is that if an owner is allowed to testify to the value of his property, certainly the court can weigh that evidence. But, I mean, the key part of that is the very last sentence says that it can't be struck. Essentially, you can't, you know, strike the owner's testimony, even if it does not give it a lot of weight. You can't strike that testimony.
The court didn't strike it. The court said it was too thin to sustain a finding. Is that valid in the court's discretion to make such a finding?
It is, but there's no competing evidence. And so the example that I would give is that if this was brought before the court on a summary judgment motion, and the court would put a fine on summary judgment that there was a trespass and damages that occurred, and there had been a declaration from Dwight Greenfield stating what the value of the damage was that had resulted as a result of the trespass, that the court found there was no question of fact that happened. And the defendant in that instance comes before the court and doesn't present any contrary evidence. Under that sort of standard, the court would have to accept the damages because there's no controverted evidence.
So if a guy comes into court and says, my duck is a dog, and the other side says, that's ridiculous, but doesn't call a witness, the court has to find the duck is a dog?
That'd be an extreme example in this case.
Yeah, obviously.
But it's within reason. And then we look at what the court's supposed to do here. The court is said supposed to use its discretion to find within reason.
But isn't our case law clear that we're not going to allow the award of speculative damages?
Right, and it's, the damages don't have to be proved with reasonable certainty, and you certainly have to take it out of the realm of whether the damages are speculative. But in this particular instance, whether or not he thought that the owner had thin evidence, he did rely upon an independent source of damages, which are MLS listings. There was a history from 2004 to 2016 where he looked at the various sales that had occurred, and he owns the trust owns 149 acres on Lake Coeur d'Alene. And so that's the type of evidence. I mean, so.
But the question here was the diminution in value to the property, right? So I read your client's testimony. He got up there. He said, I looked at the MLS for developed subdivision lots that had no improvements on them. And so it gets called out on cross-examination. That land is different. And then your client says, well, I reduced my value by $4 million to make them equivalent. And the question was, where did you get the $4 million from? And he said, it seemed fair. How is that not speculative on his part?
Well, it's from an owner's standpoint, when he's reviewing what it would cost in that, but even the context of the question that he was asked, is the $4 million is what he thought it would cost to develop the lots as opposed to undeveloped lots. So Harborview had developed lots, and his property in some instances was better with more waterfront, had more views. There was also portions of the property that didn't. But he, within the best estimate that he had with the information available, that's what he came up with in number. And so
was there any foundation laid that he had the experience or the qualifications necessary to estimate what the development costs for that land would be?
Well, the foundation that was laid was the information that he had reviewed, the reasons why he reviewed that. With regard to the $4 million, that had been a number that he had discussed with his brother and had come up to that number.
Well, but the testimony concerning the 2 to 4% decrease in property value, this was your client's testimony. The question was, did you look anything up or consult any information as to why that 2% is a fair number to you? Your client's answer was, no, it was our belief. Follow-up, so you just pulled that up out of your guys' minds, right? Answer, yes.
Correct.
So how much weight is the court required to give such testimony then?
Well, I think that it comes back to the issue is that there's no countervailing evidence. The court doesn't have to accept that it's worth $1 million or $500,000 of what he's asked for. But what the court did is that it resorted to nominal damages. When the court clearly knows, and based upon the findings of all the damage that has occurred, was not the reasonable value of the damages.
But
Mr. Friedman, if you had an expert who came in and testified to that value, that would be one thing. But I'm reminded of my father's adage when asked what the value of a piece of property was. It said, it depends on whether you're buying or selling. And I think there's a certain skepticism when an owner of property comes into court and says, well, it's worth the moon. And that simply doesn't hold much credence with a judge who's exercising his or her discretion in attributing value to that. And I think that the judge is entitled to simply reject it when there isn't any substantial evidence to support it. We say that you don't have to testify to that. We don't say the court is obliged to accept it.
And that's correct. I agree with that statement. But the issue in this particular case, and why it's important, is that If this is the decision, if this is how if a defendant comes to court and has no evidence disputing what the opinion is. Now, in this particular instance, the judge found that the evidence was thin, he didn't find that the evidence was credible, and he basically threw it all out. In cross-examination, though, they're not disputing that it wasn't $232,000 an acre. They're not disputing that the MLS listings are wrong. What they're simply saying is they're challenging the foundation and ability to testify. And within the reason why an owner can testify to the value of the property, it specifically states that, the owner is the person that does not have to be qualified as an expert.
I recognize that we have this unique distinction in our law that allows a property owner to do something that would normally require an expert to do. But we also have a very common jury instruction I'm sure you're all familiar with that says that the jury doesn't have to consider purely speculative evidence. It can give it as much weight as it wants, and it can give it no weight if it wants. Why could a jury do that, but the trial judge, if the judge was the trier of fact, as in this case, why should the judge have to give it more weight than a jury would be allowed to give it?
It's not that the judge has to give it more weight, but the judge, I think the judge reviewed this as an all or nothing proposition. It's that I either agree that the damages lie somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million, or it's nominal and not worth anything.
Where in the record did the judge say it was an all or nothing?
It doesn't say that. I'm saying that in my view, that's what the...
That's your belief.
That's my belief as to what he did. And what my argument is that if we have a case law that says there's this exception where an owner can testify to the value of its land, but then the defense doesn't put on any defense to that, and the judge can simply strike that. And even when it says that you can't exclude the opinion, it's effectively what happens. I mean, what they argue is that, like they cite the Taysom case, is the kind of controlling here, where Ms. Taysom asked for $1,000 in diminution value as a result of damage done when her husband dug a ditch into the water line and hooked up there. And the court found that there was really no credible evidence in supporting how she arrived at the figure of $1,000. She simply said, well, I could have sold it. I think it was, $1,000 for a sale. And the court rejected that. But the difference in that case was that there was, the court, first of all, said you need to restore the property back to the pre-trespass state. You have it within 5 days. And then when she asked for the diminution in value over the top of that, they rejected that. In this particular case, we have a situation where trespass was found. There was extensive damage caused. The court recognized that. There was no order to restore the property. And so we have an essence of allowing the wrongdoer to damage the property. And other than basically the harvest, the timber that was taken out, there's no compensation for any of the value that was lost to the owner. And so that's why I think that it can't possibly be the result.
Isn't it though, I know in a vacuum, if you were to say someone built a road across my property and the judge says I get no damages for that, that sounds terrible, right? But we're not looking at this in a vacuum. We're looking at this based upon a record. And the record is, did they prove damages? And as you know, in a civil case, a tie goes to the defendant. In this case, the court found that there was no weight to the evidence, or very little, and so he awarded nominal damages. Isn't that exactly what a court is supposed to do if it finds that a burden hasn't been carried?
I think that the court... It seems to me to be, when we're looking at a court's discretion, that, the court has to do something that's within reason. It doesn't seem to me that the court's, also looking at it, not looking at it in a vacuum. The court heard the evidence throughout the entire trial. The court's, and it's not just this one issue in this particular. He found the trespass occurred, he violated the easement and the damages. So the court's aware of all those facts. And so when the owner comes in and testifies, and if he doesn't believe, or find credible, how he approached the valuation, it doesn't mean that there isn't a loss. It doesn't mean that there's no value whatsoever. And so when you think about presenting a case to a jury or a trier of fact, there's testimony and it's presented and they can decide whether or not there is what the reasonable value of it would be. And under the facts and circumstances taken as a whole in this case, the reasonable value can't be $1,000.
I know Judge Christensen referred to this result as harsh. He described it that way himself. But isn't it just a fact that sometimes people can come to court with a just cause, but they lose because there was a failure of evidence?
That is true. There can be a failure of evidence.
And harsh or not, isn't that what we expect judges to do, is to evaluate and weigh the evidence, and if the result is harsh, they have to make a harsh decision? Or another way to say it is a fair decision?
There are harsh results, and that's what you expect judges to do. It's not easy to make decisions. But I also think that when a judge is sitting as the trier of fact and the judge is hearing all of the testimony and the record and has come to the conclusion that the trespass occurs and that there are damages, that, you know, to have a harsh result of saying, well, you know, just because I find this evidence to be too thin, and I'm not going to accept that, you know, this outer realm of $500 to $1 million of damage to this particular property, to, there seems to me that there's somewhere in between that. And the reason, and the main reason why it's important, is that there is no evidence on the contrary. And it's, and what I worry about and what I think about when I'm looking at this case is if there's a precedent out there that in every time that there's a landowner who goes and testifies as an owner of a property, they're never going to be as qualified as an expert. So it would seem to me that they're not going to, that basically having this unique rule is going to be completely undermined if a person is going to be able to come to court, cross-examine an owner and say, well, you don't really have, you know, the ability to testify to this. You don't have the experience and the knowledge. And the court completely, without any sort of coming back testimony or any sort of evidence to the contrary, just completely disregard that owner's opinion.
Right. Well, the issue in this case, though, isn't whether any property owner can value their property or the diminution in the property's value. The issue in this case is whether your client, the property owner in this case, did that. Certainly, we can make a ruling in this case that's not going to prevent other property owners from testifying about value, can we?
No, I mean, I think that it's a fine line. In the other cases that, you know, the Simpson case and some of the other cases that were, that were in the Simpson's case where the expert opinion was struck as to the valuation, there was at least contradicting testimony between the two parties as to the fact that there was, you know, one guy said this, the other guy said that. They said no. And then the judge didn't believe that. We don't have that here. We just basically have evidence that there was a damage. We have a court finding there was a damage. We have an owner testifying as to the best of his ability of what he came up with as to what the damage was.
This case isn't about competency. It's about the weight of the evidence, correct? I mean, the judge didn't say this witness wasn't competent in general. Just said this witness didn't provide credible testimony.
Yeah, the judge did find the witness to be competent. And it did come down to credibility. He found that it was going to give a little weight to the testimony.
Well, counsel, would you agree when it's your burden to establish damage that you need to put in something more than a guess as to damages?
Absolutely.
And when I read your client's testimony, I understand he started with the MLS to get a base value, but when I read his explanation for what he believes the diminution in value is, it seems like a guess. So help me understand how he was doing anything other than guessing about what the diminution in value was.
Well, I think that, as you mentioned, he starts with the MLS, and he reviews the sales that occurred over a period of time. And now, he's also a person who's, this property has been in the family for generations. And so when he comes to the ultimate conclusion of what it is, he's looking around and he's saying it's 232,000 acres, or $232,000 per acre. And, you know, he does the mathematical formula that he has 149 acres and kind of goes down, you know, that path. And when he ultimately, you know, says that there's $4 million that is being accounted for development, or I believe it's only 2-4%, I mean, that's his analysis. I mean, he might not be, and that's what I'm kind of going back to with regard to can an owner really testify as a witness, because an expert would, of course, like a real estate person would say, here's the market survey, here's the valuations and stuff like that.
So, counsel, is this really your client's opinion? Because the evidence suggested that this all was based upon information and calculations that were given to your client by a Christina Greenfield. And so he's basically sharing what somebody else concluded about his property.
I believe that Ms. Greenfield helped as a former real estate agent, his ex-wife, helped him gather the information, and then he reviewed the information.
Well, she gathered it, and she made the calculations, correct?
I believe it was kind of a combination of him and his brother and her.
She was the one with expertise and had been speaking on his behalf throughout the negotiations in this case, correct?
That's correct.
So these aren't even his own opinions as to the value of his property. They're the opinions of his ex-wife as to the property?
Well, that's how every opinion starts. You have to review information. and he can choose whether or not to adopt that information as, you know, his own opinion. I mean, every expert, no matter what, starts in some place, whether it's somebody else's publication that's written by, you know, another medical doctor, and they rely upon that information. That's why there's the evidence rule that experts can rely upon materials that, and it's kind of a weird...
So are you suggesting that in this situation that the ex-wife's testimony is something that would be routinely relied on by the ex-husband?
I believe the MLS listings that were gathered by her. And so I think that's the independent thing. I wouldn't agree with that. You know, she would be somebody that you could rely upon, you know, like an expert testimony that she would be reasonably able to rely upon. But what she did was simply just gather historical information of sales.
And what do you think the value of diminution that has been sustained by your client was?
Well, I believe it's somewhere in the range between what the nominal damages were and the range that he asked for.
And what did he ask for?
He asked for, I believe it was 500, and the exact number, somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million.
So are you asking us to find the district court erred by not pulling some number out of the hat between zero and 500 to $1 million, that even though there's no evidence to support that necessarily, as well, and his gut, he must have known there was something happened, so you should just assign a number to that?
I believe that what we'd be asking for is that the case remanded back to the district court, but the district court can, even if it's going to say that it's thin evidence, and he doesn't find that evidence credible, the district court was available to hear, or was there and heard all of the damage testimony. There's the damage of, you know, the harvested timber, whatever that portion of it that was awarded, but there has to be, in my mind, there has to be some sort of range in between the $1,000, which clearly isn't compensatory for what occurred on this property, and the upper range of what our client asked for. Thank you, that's all. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Grasskopf, when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Roscoff. I'm one of the attorneys for the respondent, Public Fountain Land Company, in this matter. I see behind me in the gallery is one of my clients, Mr. Steve Thayer, a member of the LLC. I appreciate your time today and hearing our position on this matter. Really, this appellant, this appeal, is asking you to do two things that you shouldn't do, and that is to set aside and completely disregard Judge Christensen's findings of fact, to conclusion of law, as that relates to the weighting of evidence, the weight of that evidence, the credibility of witnesses, and also the identification of absence of evidence. And the appeal is also asking you to send it back and require the trial court, Judge Christensen, to create a damage figure out of evidence that he has already evaluated and considered and determined was insufficient on the issue of damages. So I ask that you do neither of those things and affirm this case. William, the trust had its week in court. It had its trial. It got to present the evidence and the witnesses it had on all aspects of the case. It was a bench trial. Judge Christensen did his job, which is to sit as the trier of fact and sift through that evidence, weigh the credibility of those witnesses, assess that credibility, and weigh that evidence. And he did that, and that's not reversible error. What the appellant really wants is for the trial court to reevaluate what's already done and just come up with a different figure, one that's more palatable to them, and I'd say that that's not proper. And they're not entitled to that, and there's no reason to second-guess the reasoned opinion of the trial court. So I'd ask that, consistent with the position that this court has taken in other cases, other similar cases, that the trial court should be affirmed, in this case, should come to its final end. One fact that I do want to bring up that I believe provides some context as to how the trust and how Mr. Greenfield got here was that they did offer or had anticipated to offer an expert on restoration damages. That expert was excluded on emotional limine. That exclusion is not the subject of this appeal, but it does inform how we got there and how Mr. Greenfield kind of got in the hot seat on coming up with this diminution in value issue. And if you look at the transcript that you do have, I'm advocating for the inclusion of this witness. The trust counsel said, hey, this restoration witness is, quote, quite important to the case, close quote, and recognized on the record that absent this witness, they would have to perform a diminution in value analysis in order to seek any damages. And that's on pages 28 and 29 of the transcript. So that issue really on day one of trial set in motion Mr. Greenfield's spot, I guess, as the diminution in value expert, in part explains why he struggled getting that testimony and that evidence across, is because he was the prime lead. And that's, you know, trials are fluid, there's risk to everybody, and they had their witness excluded, and he kind of stepped in to fill the role. But it wasn't their plan from the get-go.
Mr. Freeborn, I believe, just listening to his argument, the thing that concerns him or maybe even chagrins him the most, though, is that at least they presented some evidence about diminution of value, and he claims you presented zero. Now, that was either a really gutsy slash risky slash bold approach because you were so sure you were going to win on the trespass issue, or else maybe you did present something that we haven't heard about from the record. Why was there no evidence presented from your side to rebut, weak though it may have been considered by the trial court, their evidence of value?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the issue that Mr. Greenfield made on in cross-examination, is that he had been deposed just a few weeks prior to trial, and at that time, he had no opinion on diminution in value. He was never identified as the diminution in value or the damages expert. It was, like I said, trials are clear. It was a surprise to us to have to deal with him in that manner. And we did impeach him, I believe, effectively with his own deposition testimony that was just a few weeks prior when he was asked about all those questions about damages. He didn't have anything to really say on the matter. He even said, we're going to rely on our experts.
So let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You didn't present an expert on this because you weren't expecting them to present any evidence on it at trial.
That is correct. I do think that we did effectively, though, present evidence that negated what he was saying through cross-examination. And the case law that talks about, yes, the property owner gets to get up there, gets to sit in the box, and gets to talk about what he believes to be the value of his property. It's an admissibility issue. It is not entitled to any presumptions of anything. And they say that the weight is, the case law says the weight of that testimony is another question, and goes on to say that it will be affected by disclosures made upon cross-examination, the basis for such knowledge, but will not disqualify him from getting up and as the property owner and getting that testimony in. And so that's what happened, and I think that is, in a way, absolutely presenting countervailing evidence to what he was saying. But we did not have our own damages expert due to the fact that, for the reasons I've stated there. This case is an abuse of discretion case. I believe that is a very heavy lift for the appellant in this matter. I believe it does not weigh in favor of reversing or remanding this case. As the court's aware, it is to deliberately construe the trial court's findings in favor of judgment. These findings should not be disturbed unless they're clearly erroneous. And we all recognize that it is the unique province of the trial of fact, in this case, Judge Christensen, to weigh conflicting evidence, assess credibility, and the fact that perhaps any one of you might have reached a different result at trial doesn't mean that this case needs to go back. It has to be that what Judge Christensen did was so clearly outside the bounds of his discretion and erroneous, it would have to go back. And I submit to you that that is a heavy lift, and I do not think, I think that they're asking me to do a lot. I do not think that the facts warrant in finding that an abuse of discretion occurred here. There's an issue that comes up in the appellant's brief a lot, and that's whether the, you know, the trust is entitled to damages or the damages were established as a matter of law. I believe that's correctly identified in the question. It is the trust's burden of proof to prove damages. And the trial court considered the evidence that they had and found that they didn't meet that burden. We all recognize that the speculative nature of damages is to be resolved by the trial fact. That is exactly what occurred here. The trial court's reasoning is also not any sort of secret. He set forth in his findings of fact and conclusion law, as well as somewhat in the post-trial order of exactly his analysis, right? One of the issues he had was the credibility of the witness. He said that the witness lacked confidence in the testimony that he was providing. The record indicates in the transcript that he was refreshing himself heavily from these notes in his testimony. The notes he acknowledged were not something that he created. He was also kind of obscure about when he got the notes. He couldn't answer if he got the notes the night before trial, the night before the testimony, or a few days before, which was very odd. But he was unable to answer that, which I think certainly goes to his credibility. Underlying this case, and I hope it kind of came through in respondent's brief, is that, and really, if this court just compares the plaintiff's trial brief in the clerk's pages, clerk's record, to what was presented at trial, the trust case totally changed and flipped in very material ways. And as the trustee sitting there offering testimony, I think that that probably affected his credibility as well to the trial effect. One thing also presented at trial was this claim, and Exhibit 97 is helpful to illustrate it, but the third stretch issue, a claim brought by the trust and pursued by this trustee, Mr. Greg Greenfield, was that, hey, we acknowledge that there's this easement that connects the Olive Fountain parcel to the roadway, but we're saying that you've trespassed upon this third stretch, but we cannot and will not identify where the third stretch is actually supposed to go. We're saying it's a trespass, but we can't tell you where it's actually supposed to go, even though we acknowledge that there's an easement. These things, the trial court was well aware of this going on, and I absolutely think that that also affects the credibility of this witness in material ways, not just, upon the cross-examination that he underwent in regard to damages. And ultimately, importantly, I think that the trust just found that the comparison being drawn is not helpful. He says it's of little weight. It's like comparing the trust property to the comparison he's trying to draw with the trust property to the Harborview Estates is different in very material ways. So the fact, mostly, that Harborview Estates is a fully functioning residential HOA property with roads, utilities. You can buy a lot there, a developer will, jump right on it and start building the house. The trust property has absolutely none of that. There is also testimony that isn't to give across that this first stretch where the trespass was found to occur is different from the Harborview area, and that it does have, there is no lake views from that area. It's you have to go essentially over and across a big hill before you get anywhere near a view in the lake. And so these are material differences between these properties. And so even if you were to accept the MLS numbers, what do they mean? Mr. Greenfield didn't need to prove the value of vacant lots in a residential development. He needed to prove the value of the trust property and the diminution in that value. And, he got to get the evidence in. He got to kind of say his piece, but it's not helpful to the trial of fact. And that's what Judge Christensen found. And I think that that's entirely proper. As was mentioned previously in the questioning, he did acknowledge that many of these figures were pulled up because he believed that they were either a fair number, or they sounded good to him, or to whoever provided him the analysis, but there was no other reasoning for that. So absolutely speculative, and speculative issues of damages get to be resolved by the trier of fact, which has occurred here. I do certainly do not believe that there's any case law supporting the position that the trial court is obligated to award damages that are not proven, or to search out a theory of recovery, search out a damages theory that's not offered or argued. I think that reversing or remanding in this case, it would be impossible to square that decision with Taysom or Simpson. I think those cases are really on point to this issue. Taysom is a trespass case where a trespass was found with court. This court said there that the alleged damage regarding which the respondent testifies is purely speculative and unsupported by competent evidence. Respondent failed to adduce evidence as to the value of the property after the installation related to the water line or cost of placing the land in its original condition. And then the court concluded that there was insufficient proof to award anything other than nominal damages. That is the exact case here. The trust, through its one damages witness, failed to use competent evidence. It was acceptable to the trial court to try to get where he was asking to go.
Mr. Roscoff, yes. Let me ask you to shift gears slightly and address the attorney's fee issue, please.
Sure. Yes, I think that attorney's fees are warranted, just because I do believe that the Taysom case, the Simpson case are directly on point as to the issue of how the trial of fact can view damages and the authority that they have. I also believe the case law is pretty clear as to credibility, witness issues, weighting of evidence issues, that this court is, I believe, loath to get involved in those types of determinations. And I'd ask that I think that the record supports legally that fees be awarded, because I believe the appeal is for this. I believe it is a reaction to a less than desired result, and that is it. And it's unfortunate that my clients had to pay the burden to deal with it, so I believe that fees for addressing the appeal are appropriate under the standards that Idaho law has set forth.
Counsel, you just said, I'm sorry, you just said you're entitled to attorney's fees because you think the appeal is frivolous, which would be under 12.121, which was one of two bases for attorney's fees that you're seeking. The other basis for attorney's fees that you've claimed is under 6-202. Under 6-202, are those attorney's fees discretionary, like 12.121, or are they mandatory to the prevailing party?
Can I refresh myself on the statute?
Yeah, certainly. It's the statute you cited. In
yes.
My understanding, what you've argued is that they're entitled to attorney's fees, and I'm just wondering, is that a discretionary standard, or is it non-discretionary for this court?
I believe the attorney fee provision under 6-202 is mandatory if there is essentially a trespass.
So you wouldn't have to reach the issue of whether it was frivolous or not to award fees under 6-202? If they're mandatory?
To award fees to...
You're asking for a fees on appeal. Yes. You've argued we should do so because it's frivolous, which is 12.121.
Yes.
But do we have to actually reach whether it's frivolous if we award fees under 6-202?
With the caveat that it's an issue that, as I stated today, I'm not fully prepared to answer. My belief is that it's not a frivolous standard under the statute.
If I'm reading the statute right, it says if an action for civil trespass or civil trespass with damage is brought without foundation and the defendant prevails, the defendant may be awarded reasonable attorney's fees, which shall be taxed as costs.
So that's what I was getting at then on this. So under 6202, we don't necessarily look at frivolous, but we look at maybe its close cousin, lack of foundation. So could you argue the lack of foundation as a basis for attorney's fees? What is the lack of foundation here?
I guess in order of the trial court's decision that a trespass was found, I don't think that, there's not a lack of foundation to that issue. The lack of foundation to the appeal, though, is that the issue of damages and speculative nature of damages is subject to the trial effect, and that there is direct on-point Idaho Supreme Court decisions that address the very situation where a trespass is filed, but the property owner has failed to properly present their damages. That's exact. There's no difference issue between these cases that we've cited and this instant appeal. And so for that reason, I do believe that the appeal is, would be considered without foundation, because in asking this case to be set back, you would necessarily be asking that many of these prior precedent cases from this court be overturned or significantly modified. And so.
But you mean in your answer, you said something that I think is important. You said, well, you indicated that the trust prevailed on its trespass claim. So does the statute actually authorize an award of attorney's fees on appeal to your client? I mean, because, again, the standard is, if an action for civil trespass or civil trespass with damage is brought without foundation and the defendant prevails, so can we, under the statute, do we look at prevailing party on appeal separately from prevailing party below?
Again, questions come a little off guard, so I'll admit that. But I don't know, because in my mind, this is an issue of damages, not necessarily trespass.
Well, but in fairness, appellant won below. He got $50. He prevailed on some issues, but didn't prevail on some issues, but he got $50. How does that carry up to the appeal?
Well, just to clarify the record, you may have already known this, but the request to get modified from the $1,000 nominal damage award down to the $50 was for the express purpose of obtaining the attorney fee.
He gave up $950 so that the fees would be awarded under 6202, correct?
And that was, a pill that we had to swallow in this case, and we did. But now we're dealing with a different issue, not whether the trespass occurred. That issue is settled. That issue is not appealed. It's whether or not this issue of damages, whether the trial court, sitting as the backbone, has the ability to weigh witness credibility, weigh evidence, and find that they failed to meet their burden.
Well, 12.121 also lists without foundation as grounds for attorney's fees, not just frivolousness. So it wouldn't even be necessary for us to address 6202 if we find there was no foundation, correct?
Correct.
And just to clarify, I'm throw a wrench in here. Legislature made significant changes, rewrote the civil trespass statute in 2018. My understanding is your case is under the 2016 version of the statute, correct?
That is correct. That was an issue that was brought up at the trial court. The judge and counsel all agreed that this was the due to the timing of when the actions underlying this lawsuit occurred, that this was the statute that was to be applied and has been consistently applied throughout these proceedings.
Okay, and it looks like the 2016 version allowed a reasonable attorney's fee, which shall be taxed as costs in any civil action brought to enforce the terms of this act if the plaintiff prevails. So that seems like a prevailing party entitlement to fees. And do you have any comments on that? And it's okay to say you're not prepared to answer it. I don't want to have you stand there and have to read
it. It does say that a reasonable attorney's fees which shall be taxes, costs, and any civil action brought to enforce the terms of the act if the plaintiff prevails. So the plaintiff did prevail on establishing a trespass, was awarded attorney's fees below. This issue on appeal, though, I think is the damages issue. And so I don't have a solid answer as to whether or not that would apply. It seems to only apply to the plaintiff and the defendant in this case, in all fairness. But under the appellate analysis, whether or not this appeal can be brought either frivolity or a lack of foundation, I think the fees would be avoidable then. And without getting too far into it, you know, I believe that the record supports the fact that this has been a slog in many regards for my client. It kind of has all the check marks of being a case that sometimes, a case that kind of got out of hand in regard to the fact that it's a neighbor issue and a family issue, the cases that everybody loves. So here we are. I do think that the appeal is without foundation. I do think it's brought solely due to the adverse reaction of the trial court, and I do think that fees are appropriate. If there are any other questions, I would certainly take them.
Presents.
I will give back the remainder of my time, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
And a quick comment, time remains for the applause.
9 minutes.
Anyways.
Thank you. To address the question about attorney's fees, whether this is frivolous or without or lack of foundation, I point out that it's not. I mean, as counsel just cited the Taysom case, and he says that is directly on point and there's no difference. And as I mentioned to the court in my initial argument, that case is different. That court ordered restoration damages to occur within 5 days. And he had to restore the property to pre-trespass condition. And then she asked for diminution of property value after the property was restored. In this case, there is no restoration. It wasn't awarded. The trespass occurred. The damage to the property remains. And there was the statutory trespass damage that was ultimately awarded.
But counsel, wasn't a basis for the holding in Taysom, and I'm quoting, here, however, the alleged damage regarding which respondent testifies is purely speculative and unsupported by competent evidence. How does that holding not dictate a result in this case?
Well, one of the whole considerations of why this appeal is before the court today is, the reason is Justin Morgan brought up, they have no evidence that disputed the damages. And so when you look at the case and the judge says, yeah, there was a trespass, yeah, there was damages that had occurred, and the owner has a right to testify, and he was put in that position because of trial counsel, whatever occurred there, and he's allowed to testify under Idaho law, and he comes up with what he believes to be the best way to testify. And he presents what he believes to be independent evidence, and that evidence is valued by him. And now, ultimately, the judge disregards that. And so, but there's nothing from the defendant that said his property wasn't worth $30 million, that the per acre price wasn't worth $232,000.
But doesn't Taysom stand for the premise? It's up to the trial court to determine how much weight to give to the witness's testimony. And isn't that what the trial court did here?
Yes, the trial court ultimately did determine the weight and found that because the weight was too thin, that there were no damages, more than nominal damages, to be awarded. But I go back again, just in case I understand that you're compartmentalizing it, saying on one hand they said they restored the property back to pre-trespass, and then when Ms. Taysom asked for damages over and above that, they were saying that was speculative because she couldn't prove those damages. In this particular case, I believe that it's different even if the judge found that there was a lack of credibility in the evidence, is that the property still remained damaged. And that was his best, as an owner, that was his best evaluation that he had at that time as to what the valuation of the property was. And so I don't believe that the appeal is without foundation and it's frivolous, because it begs the question of the concern that if somebody is allowed to testify as an owner and their opinion can be given no weight, and there's no competing evidence that disputes the valuation given by an owner, then is that a proper result? Is that within reason when the court clearly found there was a trespass and there was damage? And so that's why the case was appealed, and that's why
we would be asking for the court to remand the matter for determination of damages. Any other questions?
Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck to you. Appreciate it. That is under advisement. We'll have your decision.
All right.